Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I'm going to start this afternoon session with a panel. One of the really nice things about opening this up to attendance beyond just Free Software Foundation associate members is that we've been able to bring in a lot of people from all around the world. And we'd like to have this panel focus on some of the issues and talk about some of the issues that arise with free software activism around the globe under the theme of Libre Planet. So let me introduce our panelists that we have. Brian Goff is the founder of Network Theory Ltd., which publishes free software manuals. He's also a GNU maintainer, maintains the GNU Scientific Library, and has been helping to organize the GNU Hackers meetings, which have been a great event that's happened the last couple of years in the GNU projects. Ryan Vigueros is from San Francisco and has been a free software activist and organizer, especially with activities in Latin America and especially Brazil. And he owns the OWNS company, right? North by South. And Bradley Kuhn from the Software Freedom Conservancy and Software Freedom Law Center, also previous executive director of the Free Software Foundation and GNU contributor and longtime activist, helped me get started in free software too. So please welcome our panelists and we'll let them take it away.
I'm always really eager to talk to free software advocates from North America and Europe about what's been going on past decade, really, in Latin America, because I find that a lot of people, even people who are really involved in free software advocacy, don't understand the extent and the scope of what's happening in Latin America and how it can be used as used for experience and used for ideas and basically exporting what's happened in Latin America to other parts of the world, because when people find out about the real extent of what's happening in Latin America with free software, it's really beyond your wildest dreams. So to get into that, half a decade ago, President Lula da Silva of Brazil issued a presidential decree mandating that all government entities and state-owned firms were to migrate to free software, and that process began. At the same time, there were a lot of progressive initiatives that began in Brazil, and all of those were based on free software, and a lot of them were meant to address the issue of the digital divide that existed all over the world, but specifically in Brazil. And so a lot of free software programmers and developers were recruited to participate in these programs, setting up computer labs that were based entirely on free software from everywhere from the poorest parts of major metropolitan areas to the furthest reaches of the Amazon. These initiatives were going on at the same time as the government agencies and state-owned firms were migrating to open source and free software, with some failures along the way and a lot of successes along the way. And as the Latin American governments have started to come together more in a lot of other areas, so the forming of ALBA, sort of their opposition to the free trade areas of the America, or ALCA or FTAA, they've also started to come together on the technology policy. And so sort of what's happened in Brazil has gone elsewhere. So Venezuela has adopted similar laws regarding migration to free software for an entirely different reason, but the effect is the same, which is a wide popular movement that uses free software as its base. It's also moved to Ecuador. It's moved to Paraguay on a federal level where laws are being passed that mandate migration to free software and where incredible projects are being created entirely with free software. And aside from that, in Latin America, there's just in general a strong non-governmental movement for free software. But I think we're trying to keep each of our segments short. I mean, I could talk about all the different initiatives that are going on in Latin America for a long time, but in the interest of opening up to questions, I think we're keeping it to 7 or 8 minutes, and I don't know, I think I've probably reached that by now, but I would urge everybody to check out research and find out as much as they can about the movement that's been happening in Latin America, because the more you find out, the more amazed that you're going to be. And my experience, a lot of North American and European free software advocates aren't really familiar with everything that's been going on. I'm not sure of the format, but I think that we're going to
I think we'll do all opening statements and then open questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what we're
doing. Okay, is this working? Okay, good. So the title of this panel was given as Free Software Activism Around the World, and I was going to talk about a specific development in Europe concerning the original form of free software activism, writing GNU software. I'm going to talk about the GNU Hackers meetings that we've been holding. These are informal technical meetings for GNU maintainers and active contributors, typically lasting a few days with some talks. But it's not really a formal conference. It's to have time for discussion and hacking. And the main purpose of the meetings is really for people to get to know each other and to feel part of a community. There are some projects like GCC and GNOME which are big enough that they already have their own meetings and people can feel part of that as a community. But we've never really had a place where all contributors to GNU software can come together and have their own activity. If you think about all the programs in GNU, a lot of them are relatively small, and not everyone works on the big programs like GCC. And people who work on a smaller package, which could be equally, or is it in its own way, essential for something, they can't necessarily sustain a community around that package itself. So the idea of the meetings is to give people like that a place to come together. There aren't really many rewards for working on GNU software necessarily, but feeling part of a friendly community is one thing that we can offer. We've had two meetings so far, one in Spain, which was organized by GNU Spain, the Spanish chapter, and one in the UK, which I organized. And we've had people coming from across Europe to these meetings. We're planning more this year, including a week-long new hackers meeting in Sweden in November, which will be part of the FSCOM's free software conference there. I'm going to give a full talk tomorrow about the meeting that I organise, where I'll report on the various activities that we had and explain a lot more about the thinking behind the meetings and the motivation for them. There are many ways to be active in promoting the idea of software freedom today, and for some of us, the best way of contributing is writing free software. The GNU Hackers meetings are really about increasing communication and motivation among those people who want to promote software freedom by writing and working on GNU software and continuing the development of the GNU system. It's been 25 years since the founding of the GNU project, and there have been a lot of changes in that time, not least that we've really achieved the goal of having a free operating system that's available to everyone. What I found from the GNU Hackers meetings is that the GNU project has a lot of strong traditions and values that still continue to inspire people today. And the number of people who come from all across Europe, we've had people coming from Spain, from Czech Republic, from Sweden, from France, from everywhere, it really shows that there's a lot of enthusiasm to build on what we have achieved so far and continue the development of GNU, which is not just about writing free software, i.e. software that happens to be under a free license, but really about having the idea of having a system which embodies the idea of freedom in many different ways. And this sort of thing isn't always apparent when people meet up, say, at other conferences like open source conferences. People don't really talk about that kind of thing. But the GNU Hackers meeting is an environment where people can interact in a safe environment where they can discuss that kind of thing. Another reason for having meetings is that, and I'll explain more about this tomorrow, is that it's easy for people to lose motivation or to lose trust when all of the interaction is by email. If somebody who works on a project which is relatively small, there may be one of only a few people working on it, and if they, you can easily imagine in that scenario that it would be easy for them to lose motivation. So what we're looking to do by having these meetings is to really maintain people's motivation and promote trust and commitment between contributors. And that's really the role of the GNU Hackers meetings, rather than a specific technical goal. And that's what we're trying to do, given that we are a very, very dispersed group and it's somewhat difficult for us to meet. So anybody who wants to hear more about the meeting that we had in the UK and the background behind it can come to my talk tomorrow, which is in the high priority projects track. And if there are any people in the audience who might be interested in organizing a GNU Hackers meeting somewhere else, for example, maybe here in the US or Canada, come and talk to me and I can give you some practical suggestions on how to do that.
So I'm a bit daunted to be on a panel about international free software and software freedom activism, primarily because I'm admittedly incredibly U.S.-centric in my thinking. And the most important thing I just remember about the international world is it doesn't work the same way as the U.S. But I tend to understand mostly only how the U.S. works, in part because I'm a little bit afraid to fly longer than 7 hours or so, so I don't go outside the U.S. that often, as it turns out. And I've spoken some in Europe and Canada, but that's about the extent of my international travel. And the place where I think the U.S. is unique in regards to activism is we're a generally apathetic nation, honestly. We're not a nation that has done a lot of activism since basically the 1960s and early 1970s. And therefore, it's difficult, more difficult here, I think, than other places to get people excited about a political or philosophical issue of incredible importance just by talking to them and convincing them. People outside the U.S., I think, are much more willing to think, wow, there's an important political thing and maybe I should get involved with it. But there is one truism, I think, of all political activism. Every movement is run by the people that show up. And people used to ask me how I ended up being the executive director of the Free Software Foundation. And the truly honest answer is I showed up. Really, I showed up. And I showed up at first by following Richard Stallman around at conferences. I remember distinctly at the 1997 USENIXX, following him around after his talk, trying to ask him questions, following him into the bathroom. Never follow somebody famous into the bathroom. It's really rude. And I'm glad Stallman is an awkward enough person that he was not truly offended by that, because he might make the same mistake that I did of following him into the bathroom, talking to him about, you know, I really care about free software, and I really want to get involved. And that leads me to the other point I want to make in my opening statement here, that doing things that need to be done is incredibly important. Most people, and I think the biggest mistake that people make when they try to get involved in free software activism, is they go immediately to the thing that interests them the most. And I have actually never done that. If I went to the thing that interests me the most, I probably would have ended up being a GCC contributor, because I studied compilers in graduate school, and that's what I was sort of trained to do. But there was already plenty of people working on GCC and involved in compiler hacking and programming language hacking. And I would go to RMS and ask him, what is the most important thing to work on? And I ended up doing a series of incredibly boring jobs for RMS, like planning, like coordinating his speaking travel, which is done by the job that I created at FSF, RMS Assist, which still exists. That was my first job at FSF. And within a year of being RMS Assist, he decided to make me executive director, just sort of randomly one day. He said, maybe I should just put you in charge. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. So I ended up being in charge of the FSF. Even once I was in charge, my goal was always not to do what was most exciting or interesting, but to find the places in the free software space that weren't getting addressed and chase them. This is why I'm glad we still have the high priority projects list at FSF. Those are the kinds of things that FSF's always been very good at doing, naming things that really need attention. And you know, being somebody, I'm not as smart as Stallman. I'm not somebody who can immediately see the problem and the best way to address it. But I'm really good at following directions, and I'm really good at working hard on something once I believe in it. So I've always looked to my elders in the free software world and said, you know, what is the problems we need to be working on the most? And tried to work on those and tried to get active about those. So that's sort of my central philosophy of free software activism, is show up and work on something that looks really urgent and nobody else is working on. So I think now we're gonna try to keep this interactive and open to questions. And Jeremy was the first guy with his hand up. So can we hand a mic to Jeremy and get started with the questions?
So I was really interested in your comments about Latin America and how active free software is there. Now, and you said find out about it. Well, the interesting thing is, sort of living in the US or whatever, is you will never see that stuff. You will never see reports of successful Linux installations or whatever. That information is never reported, mainly because there's nobody sitting there funding or spoon-feeding the press with press releases, which is how you actually get things reported in the US. So where do we find out about that stuff? Because it would be really nice to be able to, whenever you get one of these sort of Microsoft-funded sort of, oh, Linux fails in Staffordshire Police Force or whatever it is, you know, which they love trotting out, to say, oh, Linux succeeds on 300,000 desktops in Brazilian government studies that you could point people at. And the other useful thing with that is I've done a little bit of lobbying politicians, and governments like to talk to other governments. They don't like to talk to grubby citizens and, you know, the hoi polloi. They like to talk to people like them. So if there's, you know, if you could point us at, if you could put something online where we could go to actually get this information out, that would be really helpful.
Yeah, we did. you can go to news.northxsouth.com. And whenever I do talk about it, I do say, like, I think that it's the only English language website that specifically addresses the free software movement in Latin America. And I think you're right that ask and you shall receive. For the most part, you know, when Brazil first moved to free software, or when there's something really major that happens, there's some some press about it in the Western media, but for the most part, I think you're right that it's ignored, and I think that, you know, part of that too, it falls on the North American and European movements, in that they're not aware of what's going on, and so they're not actively promoting awareness or you know, going out of their way to talk about, you know. You say that, you know, if someone says to you, you know, free software, it's never really been, you know, tested or what have you, you know, as well, it's running one of, you know, running a country that's the size of the United States, you know, it's an emerging economy, you know, it's basically taken over an entire continent that they're comprised of emerging markets and emerging economies. So, and that's why I say that Latin America is such an incredible example that we could be using if we knew more about it.
Somebody should run the mic for John. John had to run the mic at the first FSF membership meeting like 4 years ago.
I showed up.
He showed up and ran the mic. The problem is you get stuck doing the same thing over and over again. So maybe somebody should give John a break from running the mic. Oh. I think that was the joke.
First of all, I'd like to apologize for the fact that I'm lousy with names. So would each of you mind just, you know, telling me what your names are so I know who to direct the question to?
I'm Brian.
Ryan.
And I'm Bradley.
Ryan, Brian, and Bradley?
Yep, sounds good.
Brian, Ryan, okay. okay, so my
question... Just say guy on left, right, middle.
My question is for Ryan, the one in the middle. You know, just a few years ago, Eric Chris, here in Massachusetts, chief technology officer for the state at the time, issued a directive to state government that was, you know, really not that radical. It was simply that... state employees, when they wanted to requisition software, not as it was portrayed that they had to use free software, but rather that they had to consider it as one of their choices and make a case for, you know, which of the possible choices out there you know, was the most cost effective. The end result, as reported on Grok Law and as reported by one of the attorneys who created Grok Law in a speech that I heard, was that Microsoft pulled some very underhanded, very dirty tricks, caused, I can't remember Chris's right-hand man's name, but basically caused him to get fired by releasing a bogus story about him doing something, you know, spending money he wasn't supposed to have spent. Clearly, Microsoft... with, you know, whose value is roughly the same size as the amount that Bernie Madoff swindled, has the resources to target anybody they choose to and pretty much bring them down. So when you said that the president of Brazil decided that, you know, that Brazil from thenceforth was going to use free software, I'm wondering how she dodged the bullet, and one of the things I'm wondering is, was there, you know, what was there sort of a national pride issue here? We're not going to be ruled by those, you know, people up north, or what, you know, how did she manage not to get her entire administration brought down?
Sure, and it's not just Brazil, right? Other countries who are a lot smaller than Brazil. I mean, what you're saying is legitimate. That you know, Microsoft certainly has the power to create problems for governments that take a stance like this. Brazil is, you know, a huge country with a huge economy. I mean, it's much smaller. Countries have gone the same route and face the same threat. You know, like Ecuador, Bolivia is doing it, Nicaragua, El Salvador, etc. Part of the reason that that Latin America is going in this direction, I think, is that it's part of the generation that has come to power are the first progressive leaders who are coming to power once democracy has been restored to in countries in Latin America. So, you know, for 500 years there was colonialism, and then there was imperialism, and then there was just outright military dictatorships that were supported by the United States, and those started to be overthrown in the 80s and up into the 90s. And the movement that's happening in Latin America is broader than just technology, but technology is a part of it. And so there are issues of technological sovereignty in choosing free software. Aside from that, just the values of free software sort of sync up with the values of this generation of people who are putting into power these progressive leaders. I mean, Lula's party is the Workers' Party, you know, which has traditionally been like a socialist, what socialist parties call themselves. Hugo Chavez has outright said that he's a socialist. Cuba is a communist country. Ecuador is run by a president who's affiliated with socialist parties, et cetera. So, yes, I think the answer to your question is that it is an issue of technological sovereignty, that Latin America as a continent has said that we're not going to be America's United States backyard anymore, and that this is part of that. And, you know, the huge – and again, I think this is something that's underreported in Western media or – intentionally misreported, but there is a really strong movement in Latin America right now, which is a reaction to decades of military dictatorships, death squads, disappearances, and the free software movement is just the technology arena's participation in that broader movement.
Yeah, and one thing to note is in the U.S., maybe we're beginning right now because of what's happening in the economic climate to realize that corporate corruption is a central part of what tends to move things around here. In other countries, people realize that longer ago than we did, if we've even realized it yet. And so there's a likelihood they're going to be more quick to react to corporate corruption and call it out. I met a lot of people who had got involved in software freedom advocacy from the OOXML ODF wars, because there were all these ISO meetings around the world where it was one of these situations like we're talking about. The people who showed up got to speak because hardly anybody showed up, as Jeremy pointed out in his talk. Of course, the decision had already been made, but when people showed up to speak about the problem, realized that the decision had already been made by some company buying people off, that got them angry enough to get involved in activism. So that's one thing to keep in mind about when Microsoft goes around and buys the ISO in every country to make OOXML pass. They're actually inspiring a generation of activists who are going to get excited. So it's not all bad when they do that, because it backfires on them, and it will continue to backfire on them, I think.
You know, do any of you see any lessons from this, how this has played out in other regions of the world that are in any way applicable to U.S. society?
Yeah, I think that when you look at some of the other areas of the world that have started to adopt free software as policies, you can see that they sort of follow this pattern. Another country outside of Latin America that has been really moving towards free software is South Africa, and again they share a lot in common with Latin America in that, you know, an apartheid regime was propped up there by, you know, the United States and the United Kingdom for years and years, and so they have this sense of wanting technological independence from Microsoft. In India, states that are controlled by more progressive parties have also started to shift to free software. And so I think the lesson that can be taken out of it is that and RMS has spoken a lot about this, which I find interesting, and we write about it on our news site, which is that there are reasons for adopting free software, like issues of sovereignty, that can be more appealing to people than just cost or ideas of code freedom. You can appeal to people from a stance of sovereignty and independence, which are feelings that run a lot deeper than just, you know, some of the things that people in the United States and the United Kingdom find important.
My question is for Brian. Maybe you can speak to this. We were talking about writing code and then adoption, and I'm wondering if there's a correlation to having hackers in different places and the adoption. So I don't know if we have lots more people writing code in Brazil now because the government supports it. And then sort of a second piece of that is, where do you think the newer places that we're recruiting people to write GNU code are these days? Like, what's on the horizon? So maybe that'll be where we'll see more adoption.
Is that a question for me?
Yes.
I don't know anything about the... really about the question of adoption. So I can't really comment on that. I would say that in terms of where we're getting contributors in the GNU project, what we're seeing is essentially a form of promotion where maybe people who are maintainer on a distribution like Debian, if the GNU maintainer retires, then they will step up and become a GNU maintainer. So I think that's where most GNU contributors are coming from these days.
Yeah, I think one of the problems that I've seen, mostly in India. I've talked to some folks who have tried to do free software advocacy in India. It's very difficult to get, despite, you know, at least in the of people who would actually be have the training to contribute to open source and free software. Sorry, I said open source. those folks are generally in their own communities internally, and even though they have internet access, they're not really getting in touch and collaborating with the upstream folks, who are mostly Europeans and U.S. folks and U.S. Canadian folks mostly. It's a really big challenge for international activism of trying to get the code bases of free software coordinated in a way that actually has people able to contribute upstream. A lot of the Brazilian free software development that I've heard about, and it's actually, I'm a couple years behind on this, so maybe you can correct me, but it's a lot of internal stuff that's getting built. Like, I heard a couple years ago about this, like, full replacement of Lotus Notes that they did in Portuguese that's widely used throughout Brazil. It's under GPL, but it's never been translated in any language but Portuguese, and it's not used widely outside of Brazil. And they're not really connected up with people doing the same kind of work, replacement work for the same products in the U.S. and Europe and so forth. So it's a real challenge. I don't have, maybe you have some ideas of how we could start to bridge those gaps.
Yeah, I think that last year, for the first time, Brazil organized a congress of Latin American countries who were developing free software. And you're right, there are a lot of new pieces of software, or one that they really push is called Expresso, which is something that's built on PHP groupware that they use internally a lot. And so the first step for them is that they wanted to get together all the Latin American countries and start to coordinate on that level. So applications that were written just in Portuguese, getting those translated to Spanish, and then go from there and translate into English. So there are efforts towards coordination, and I think those will continue.
Yeah, it seems like India is such an obvious choice because everybody who's educated in India speaks English. So there's no language barrier with India, and I'm sort of at a loss of how to better integrate the Indian free software developers with people in the sort of traditional European and U.S. And North American free software space. It's, if anybody's eyes on that, bring them up, because it's been quite a challenge, I think.
One thing I'd say on the subject, which I'm going to be talking about tomorrow, is that I do think one of our problems is that we are very dependent on email as a form of communication, and that's not really conducive to building personal relationships, which is what you need to get people really committed to working on projects.
There's a couple.
We're waiting for people to bring you mics. That's why we're not calling anybody. Somebody has a mic up there, yeah. So let's start there.
I have a question for Ryan. Going back to the freedom and the interoperability of other countries and other cultures. South America is much like Scandinavia, where they're more socialist-oriented and they're open and integrated and willing to think out of the box. And then you have countries like China that are more, you know, we're going to control everything in Saudi Arabia, that they're going to control everything that goes in and out of their walls. What I see in the movements of South America politically as well as information is the imperialism, the colonialism, the paramilitaryism. Their key approach was to keep education and information out of the hands of the masses. So when I looked at Tiananmen Square, and that was only made possible because of the old fax machines, you could hide the data that you were faxing back and forth. Only the person that picked up the fax could see it and the person making it. Now faxing is all integrated. Everything's integrated online where anything can be looked at and extricated. And how do you see, I just see that activism politically and free software activism almost has to go hand in hand. And it has to be started at a grassroots and educational level. And without that integration, it'll never take off even here.
Yeah, I think there's validity to it. I mean, how I got involved with working with Latin American free software developers was over a decade ago when opposition to FTAA, Free Trade Agreement, ALCA, was beginning. I started working on projects that were that included Latin American developers because they were building support software for people who were opposing those trade agreements. Certainly in Latin America, the movement towards free software goes hand in hand with this broader activism movement, and Brazil, sort of the same forces that are pushing towards free software are the same forces who created the World Social Forum as a counter to the annual meeting. So, at any rate, what's that? Yeah, exactly, Davos. So the World Economic Forum. So the World Social Forum. It's this group of people who are really pushing for free software. I think that within the North American and European free software world, there's always been a controversial thing about tying it to politics. And you have some folks who want to tie it to libertarian politics, which certainly don't mix with the kind of politics that Latin American movement is talking about. And then you have some people who argue that, you know, I guess these are more the open source people, but there's still a lot of people who say just keep politics out of it because that's not going to help us achieve adoption. I think in Latin America, and maybe this is another lesson from Latin America, is that if you want free software to be adopted by governments, all the massive corporations on an entire continent, then maybe it doesn't need to be tied to a broader activist movement that shares those values. In the United States and other places, we've been unsuccessful in doing it segregated from anything political, from a broader context.
Yeah, it just seems to me that if we trained a majority of the end users, the others have to follow. They have to turn back to them because their user base, their consumer base, is all oriented in one specific manner. And education is just the only way, like through the school programs, I'm thinking. I don't know.
Something you mentioned gave me an idea that in a country like Brazil, where there are so many people that may be using free software, that there's a considerable amount of development work going on as well. The spreadsheet program that you mentioned probably could be a good asset if it were translated back and brought back here, or to at least translate it into English. I would think that FSF would have an interest in identifying those applications that are being developed elsewhere and bringing them back here, perhaps even pay a little bit to do it. Just an idea.
And you know, to go on with that, there's even some really important works. Cuba, part of the free software work that Cuba does is reverse engineering device drivers for medical equipment because of the embargo that they have against them. Sometimes the EU has an embargo against them, but always the United States has an embargo. And a lot of the work that they've done have been, you know, heart monitors or what have you. They reverse engineer the device drivers, and then that's free software that they give away, that they don't have any proprietary license on. I don't know if it's specifically GPL, but it would be if they knew, you know, if they were prompted to do that. So I agree. There's a ton of software being produced in Latin America, especially important stuff like that, that should be integrated into the broader movement around you know, the U.S., U.K., European movement. It's why I'm always always excited, always interested in talking as much as I can to whoever I can about what's going on in Latin America for all these reasons that we're talking about.
This is actually part of a broader problem, which basically free software ends up being a victim of its own success, because there's so many free software sub-communities now around particular code bases, around particular programming languages, around particular library sets that don't interact that much. And it's very difficult to get them interacting. I think the hacker meetings you're talking about is a good way to get developers who are working on basically orthogonal systems to meet each other. Because I see a lot of folks who don't know about each other's libraries, don't know about each other's software work, and it's basically still a word-of-mouth situation to get people hearing about other people's software projects. And we are facing that scaling challenge right now as a community that I don't have any specific solutions for. I'm just pointing at the problem and talk to people who work in different languages and use and so forth.
Yeah, and on your original point, I'm certainly aware of in Europe, there are Spanish applications in things like ERP, enterprise resource planning, which, as far as I'm aware, they're really only available in Spanish, which could be translated and made generally available. But I do think this comes down to a problem of communication. But when the GNU project started, it was a question of everybody. Essentially, the components were independent, and we could all work on them individually. But now that phase is really over, and we're into an integrative phase now, which really depends on having more communication between all these different sub-communities.
I don't know. The guy on the left? Right?
The left?
Brett?
Bradley.
Bradley. I know how to be in it. You talked a bit about getting people involved in important projects and areas in free software. And one of the things that I found, even with myself, even though I consider myself, I guess, moderately technical, is that there's kind of people are put off and don't know exactly what they could do for free software because they think that maybe the advocacy might be over their head or that they can't specifically code. How would you market or advertise to people to get involved that aren't necessarily as technical as others?
It's a hard question for me to answer because I am technical, and it's hard to imagine what folks go through who don't want to program. It's funny because I was primarily a programmer, and I never really did much programming on free software, going back to this philosophy of everybody seemed to want to write programs for free software. And I said, well, what's actually more urgently needed? Most people need coordination help, and there are always logistics related to projects that they need help with. And you can only really find out about them if you want to by joining their mailing lists or listening to what they're complaining about. That's really the best way to do it. One of the first things I did, and I don't know if I want to own up to this, for Free Software Project, is I ran the voting for naming the GNU Cache project, which was not – I wrote a little script to do it, but it didn't have to be technical. I could have just kept track of all the emails and counted up the votes. I don't like to take credit for it because the name's not that great, but that's what won. And everybody voted. Everybody in the community voted, and that's what they decided on. But that was not a technical job. And the reason I knew about that is because the last proprietary program I used on a regular basis was Quicken, and I was looking for a replacement. So I subscribed to the GNU. Well, then it was the X account mailing list, which they were looking for a new name. And I said, well, that's something easy I can do. I don't know anything about this code base, but I can run their program to vote for a new name. And there's little administrative things that every project needs that you can find if you ask the right people. I'm sure if you talk to people around here, they're working on some project that has an administrative need. Now, administrative work is boring as hell, but people are really appreciative of it, and it really needs to be done. My work with the Software Freedom Conservancy, we're all about serving the administrative needs of projects. Now, I don't want to sit there and watch bank accounts. You know, I mean, I'm actually trained as a programmer. I really am. But the thing is, there's nobody else who's willing to watch a bunch of bank accounts for projects, so I do it. And, you know, Jeremy calls me up and tells him when the Samba project needs to spend money on something, and I do it. Yeah, it's boring, but that way Jeremy can be off working on Samba, which is really important. So there's lots of little things like that. And heck, if you want to do administrative work, I have a list of volunteer administrative projects you can do for Conservancy. See me later.
One area that I would just say an answer to that. One area that I would say where less technical skill is needed, which is an incredibly important area, is documentation. Mm-hmm. In terms of increasing adoption of free software, basic tutorial information that, say, a moderately skilled user could easily write, explaining to somebody who doesn't know anything about a piece of software to get them up to speed, we are severely lacking in that area. And we've got the book sprint here at this meeting as one example, but if somebody has knowledge how to use software, then writing a tutorial is a really good way to help people who know nothing.
Yeah, one other thing I wanted to add, because you said you were somewhat technical. One of the things I do now when I want to get involved with a new project is I start writing test coverage for it. And writing tests is some of the more easy to get your mind around programming that you can do. So if you're a little bit of a programmer, most free software programs don't have good test coverage because most of them were started before we started to realize you should write tests first and then write the code. You know, we're still all getting used to that idea. So going in and finding what code's not covered with tests and writing tests is a great way to get involved if you want to do a little bit of programming but aren't really hardcore yet. And I even do that myself when I'm new to a project because it's an easy way to learn the code base.
And
it's easy to do while you watch TV. I write tests a lot while I watch TV.
I'd add in that this is another place that we could learn, take a lesson from Latin America, which is that one of the most impressive projects that go on there are the opening of computer labs, community computer labs. And so you can, and it's all based on free software and open source, and it's a way to get people comfortable with using an open free software desktop, a free software user interface, free software programs like OpenOffice, and you can see that the majority of the work involved in setting up a community computer lab is not technical, you know. There is, but I mean, you know, finding a space.
Lots of tutorials for it, so you can learn it.
Yeah, finding a space, getting it set up, coordinating all that work is all non-technical work. And it's another vehicle that's spread the use of free software in Latin America.
Oh yeah, just a comment about I'm from Mexico and I'm involved in the Mexican community. Hi, Ryan.
Yeah.
In the past, with the past president, all the presidential thing, the servers, the website, and all that was based in open source, and there was a very strong support for open source movement. But with this new president, it all rolled back because these guys. some kind of related with someone in Microsoft. And the problem we're facing now is that we're pushing ideas for the government to adopt open source in their offices so that expenses go lower. But what we're encountering is that Microsoft give bonuses to these guys that buy the software. So because we have bad salaries and all that, the corruption is very easy for Microsoft to push all this software. And well, we're keeping this battle, and we're still fighting that, and hope in the next president or something we can change that. And unfortunately, this president gave Bill Gates a medal a couple of months ago.
Yeah, and the other problem is that the rioting after the election just didn't last long enough.
Yeah, they didn't.
That's really the problem.
Yeah, and well, that's just
you should have imported militants from Oaxaca, and that would have been the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is, I think, one of the challenges of tying these things to political parties. I mean, sometimes you have to because you're riding a wave and you're getting something done, but you run into problems like this where a party's out of power and then you're stuck. I mean, I like to think of free software activism as primarily to try to be as apolitical as possible. It's one of these great ideas that eventually every party's going to adopt. I mean, as you point out, libertarians say, well, you know, free software fits exactly with the libertarian philosophy. Communists say the same thing. Capitalists say the same thing. And so we're one of these things that's such a good idea that we can make it, you can pitch it to fit any political ideology. And so I just try to focus on, you know, rights and freedoms of computer users and try not to get too political as far as political parties go, because you never know when a particular party is going to go out of power.
Yeah, I'm going to... well, to follow up on that, I guess... I think it hasn't been politicized enough in some ways. I mean, we can see these sort of intricate linkages between socialism and free software. And, you know, I'm wearing this thing that calls me an activist or whatever. And then, like, the largest U.S. gathering of activists, the Free Software Foundation wasn't there at the U.S. Social Forum. And I think that actually linking and, like, trying to talk to activists, political activists about free software, they're like, you know, fuck you. I'm happy with my Facebook and being able to connect with these people really quickly, and I don't care about free software. So, I mean, actually enhancing the political message could be really important.
We've been thinking kind of along those lines at the FSF. I don't know if you saw something that we published a year and a half or so ago, freesoftwarefreesociety.org, which was a statement that we got a number of other non-technical activist groups to sign on to, using the occasion of opposing Vista, but also just promoting the importance of free software, avoiding having proprietary filters on your free speech and your activism is important for any kind of group. So, I mean, at least we totally agree, and we're trying to move in that direction in terms of getting non-technical organizations that have any kind of political agenda, doesn't matter what it is, everybody has the common interest of needing to have unfiltered communication with whoever their supporters are, and, you know, networking capabilities and all that sort of thing.
I have a people who show up answer to your question somewhat. Nonprofits, generally speaking, 501c3 nonprofits in the U.S., are the most free software unfriendly of all organizations. They're even more free software unfriendly than for-profit corporations, because for-profit corporations basically make decisions based on bottom lines, and it's easy to show with the open source arguments why their bottom line is better. But the other thing that's true about nonprofits is that they're very technologically unsavvy. I mean, I'm talking about nonprofits outside of our space. So if you have another cause that you're excited about, you know, be environmentalism, whatever it is, find the nonprofits in your area that are doing work in that regard and go volunteer for them specifically on technology issues, giving them free software solutions, because they probably really need the help technologically. And if you're saying, I'm willing to volunteer, but I'm only going to do free software, they'll probably say, okay, as long as it works, and just make it work. And that's a great way to cross over that space between other activists, because they get these near zero cost licenses from Microsoft, and they're just happy to keep taking it. And the biggest technology sort of forum for nonprofits in the U.S. called N10 is basically owned by Microsoft. So it's really hard to get the message across to them. But volunteering always gets their attention. So it's one way to help bridge that gap, I think.
I would add just really quick that the movements that were connected to Latin America, I mean, how I got involved with Latin American free software programmers revolved around organizations like Indie Media, and the technical groups within there are extremely committed to free software and open source, whereas maybe the free software advocates aren't present at the activist things. The tech activists within the movements are 100% about free software. So,
we have time for just one more question.
I just wanted to ask if you really did believe the last point you made, Bradley, about the it's such a good idea, everyone can agree with it, like the libertarians agree with the free software is a good idea, capitalists agree it's a good idea. Is that really true, though, about free software? Because Jeremy was making the point earlier that they really like BSD licensing. They like the idea of open source things that they can raid, but GPL software capitalists don't like. Is that, or am I wrong?
I don't think that's true. I think that a lot of the capitalist type people, I mean, IBM's a great example, really prefer the GPL because it keeps their competitors from being able to, it basically creates the space they feel safe in, because with BSD stuff, they can get undercut by their competitor and their competitor can take their technology and build on it and not get back. But GPL creates this common space that they can trust. So I think, you may be right about the libertarians. I mean, if Eric Raymond is the representative of libertarians, I don't know.
What's it? Yes. You've got two members of the Libertarian Party of Massachusetts State Committee sitting in the audience right now.
Okay, so there you go. Talk to them if you want to hear a libertarian support free software versus open source. But I think the freedom arguments work well. I mean, the free software arguments work well with pretty much people from every part of the political sphere that I've talked to. I haven't found a political philosophy that I can't find a way to craft the software freedom argument to them that makes sense, not just the open source argument. And people who basically don't, U.S. people are responsive to the open source thing because, like I said in my opening statement, people in the U.S. are incredibly apathetic, and that's something we have to learn how to change as a culture. And I have no idea, because I'm not a sociologist, to understand how to make U.S. people unapathetic. But if you find somebody who is truly unapathetic and has some sort of passion about some philosophy, I think generally you can find a way to make it's like anti-slavery, right? I mean, the anti-slavery arguments you can make in every spectrum because it's right to be against slavery. Free software, I think, is actually the same way.
We have just one note here, and then we have to.
Okay, sure.
Panel.
Yep.
But everyone is still here, so you can pass them at the break.
So I have a question for everyone about the range of laws in various countries and any changes in them, which is making it easier or more difficult for the adoption of free software vis-a-vis the issue of government procurement, especially such that it's very difficult here in the U.S. to even get something that says, well, government ought to evaluate on equal terms the open source software as opposed to the opposing position, say, in France, where I'm given to understand that government procurement laws favor open source solutions for economic benefit, and there's some sort of EU directive about that. I'm especially interested in what extent other European countries have taken the EU directive that isn't written very strongly and tried to do something with that.
Well, I'm not really familiar with the details, but it's certainly a general trend in Europe. In the UK, we're coming up towards an election, and all of the three main parties are talking about, well, open source, but they're saying that they're in favour of it, and that's all of them, so that's an encouraging sign. Whether that will actually translate into anything in the long run, it's really difficult to say, because there have been a lot of announcements which don't really come to anything. But certainly the trend is in that direction.
I just wanted to add real quick before we have to end. I have proposed something for tomorrow that goes deeper into all the different stuff that's happening in Latin America, because you could go on and on about it forever, and there's a lot of really interesting things that have happened. So I'm not exactly sure how tomorrow's working, but I've at least proposed it. So if you're interested in further, go to it if it happens.
And my closing statement is that Evan is an excellent example of somebody who saw a problem, showed up, and started working on it. So I'm going to stop talking and let him talk.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.